One of these days, I'm gonna learn to do this, like, you know, the fancy podcast thing, and have some like cool music and, you know, all that jazz somehow, you know, opening this podcast. Yeah, right now I feel like talking. Sat down to write, and you know, felt I'd defer to verbal expression. So here I am talking, and I'm gonna talk about horizons. Literally, like where I position my horizon. Like what becomes the limit of my purview, both physically, really just really spatially, and existentially, and the ways those two things really become interchangeable, the meaning the existential and the spatial. This is what made me think of it. It's something I've thought about a lot in my life. But I was thinking about it the other night. I was lying in bed. It was bedtime. It was nighttime. And I was lying there. And I suddenly sort of realized that my head was kind of spinning, as it were. It's, again, another spatial figure spinning for something that's invisible. My head was not actually spinning as far as I could tell. It's not The Exorcist. But I was playing through something. I was playing through, you know, various ideas I had, or I'll say anxieties, but anxiety, it wasn't anxieties about them. The anxiety was the whole mode of expression, if you will. But I was thinking about possible future states of myself, and I was thinking a little bit about money and some investments I have and how to manage them. And I was thinking a little bit about my sweetie, and I don't know. But while I was sitting there thinking about these things, I realized, where was I looking? My eyes felt almost scrunched. Even though they were closed, they felt scrunched. And I felt almost like the edges of my head or my face were sort of turned inward. My whole body was a little tight. And I realized my point of focus, my horizon, which I realized point of focus and horizon are two different things. I'll say my horizon, the end point, the thing that sort of loomed as the limit term of what could even be in focus, was my thinking about possible scenarios. And so my horizon was an abstraction. Right? It was a possible state. It was something that could happen. And thinking about whether I might want that to happen, not happen, how I would react to it, but it existed nowhere, right? So I was focusing, right? And it was quite visual. It's very hard for things, I think, not to be visual, right? Even with our eyes closed, there's quite a lot we see, right, with our eyes closed. But there was a kind of tightness and a kind of, again, I talk about the sort of inward, the scrunched eyes, this this furrowed brow. You know, think about if something's right in front of you, right? Like someone shows you something very small. Like, look at this tiny picture. Look at this diamond ring. You know, me, I got to take off my glasses because I'm old, and that's how I can focus. But I furrow my brow to focus closely. But here, I wanted to focus on something that wasn't even in front of my eyes. It was behind my eyes. It was as if I was trying to focus, like throw my eyes together to look just behind themselves, to see this world unfolding, this imaginary world, this sort of possible world. Usually a possible world defined by misadventure, by folly and error. But I there I am. I'm lying on this bed. I got a nice bed. I'm on this nice mattress. I'm in my room. You know, there's sort of it's mostly dark, but there's some light coming through the perforations in the shades, and you know, from the street light and from the moon. And My focus was not there. My focus was not in the feeling in my back or my body as it lay against the sheets. No, it was focused on a point or horizon, which is not really a point per se, of event that had yet to happen, might never happen, right? It was pure sort of fabrication. And I really felt it as a physical thing, right? That there was this, that I was lying there and I'm having some anxiety and I'm trying to sleep and I'm kind of involuting, I'm kind of flipping my eyes around, flipping my whole body around to kind of see this thing, to see the situation, to see how it could play out. But of course I can't open my eyes and look about me, right? Because it's not out there. So it's like an attempt to fold in on myself in order to literally see, in order to focus on this scenario which has not happened. And it's not a premonition. The thing I'm focusing on is not a premonition. At the risk of sounding like a fruitcake, I've had premonitions. I think we all do. I think time is complex, and we can see how certain things will unfold. I think the present, past, future relationship is a complex one, as everything is sort of interconnected. So, I've clearly had premonitions, and that focus is somewhere else. That focus is not actually internal. I'm actually not flipping my eyes around to kind of see inside myself in the case of a premonition. In the case of this anxiety, in the case of thinking through all the various ways things could go wrong, ways I could fuck up, you know, either my money or my relationship or my life, or, right, was in this radical kind of twisting in. I'm an internal horizon, but an internal horizon that doesn't see the infinite ocean of my internal becoming. No, the point of focus, right? Because I think there is an infinite internal focus, and it begins to get complicated. But there's, you just think about this. Sometimes, going to a meeting and you play the meeting out in your head, or you're going on a date, when you're playing it out in your head a little bit of things that might happen, the ways you might want to react, and your point of focus becomes that. And that point of focus can kind of lean in to what's imminently happening, what might be happening soon, right? Which becomes a beginning of a movement from an internal state to an external state. But then there's another kind of anxiety, one I think we're all familiar with. I hope this doesn't sound totally insane. It's certainly familiar to me, and I see it in people who've been close to me. But it's an anxiety that's is a point of focus that's just behind the eyes, that doesn't look to the infinite becoming that I am internally, but to a possible state of an event and the permutations of that event. What was so striking to me about this experience, this moment of reflection I had, was how physical this idea of focus suddenly became. As I get older, I wear lots of different glasses, and my point of focus it moves, and I have several different pairs of glasses depending on what I want to have in focus. And I'll talk more about glasses and focus in a second, but it's a very real thing. What is the thing you see clearly? Where do your eyes go, right? There's a funny aspect of the iPhone camera app. There's that little yellow box that you can decide to make. You tap that, and that becomes the point of focus of the lens. Right? Cameras are quite stupid, right? Cameras don't know the difference between here or there, between a face, a tree, a sky. Cameras don't know anything. They don't know what to focus on. Autofocus in cameras is a kind of creepy thing because it's so humanistic, right? It sort of assumes you always want to focus on the face, right? And so it has various, you know, algorithmic parameters or parameters within its algorithm to zero you the camera in on a face as opposed to maybe on the face to be blurred. And what you're actually taking a picture of is the blurred face with the tree in focus. So you want it all in focus. Or you want none of it in focus. You want pure blur, which is a trick you got to learn on the iPhone, right? To try to, so it won't focus on anything, hard to come by. And autofocus is actually a great figure. It's a great figure. It's just as autofocus on a digital phone is prejudice, right? It's algorithmic, so it's just responding to certain rules, but it's fed by what are the things people want to have in focus, and it's always assumed that it's the face. So if you point the camera at something, it goes for what it thinks is a face, and even spatially, it goes for things in the center. Right, maybe you want the thing way up in the left-hand corner to be in focus and the rest to be blur. But in our sort of humanist culture, and I don't mean that pejoratively per se, but I think it's apt to call it humanist. You know, we put the face, the human face, at the center of things. And that's quite telling. And I think our own training as human beings, our own sort of construction of ourselves, and who we are and how we go in the world, begins to take on a kind of autofocus. Right? There are things we just go to focus on, right? So I'm lying in bed, you know, I'm a 48-year-old man, right? I mean, I've done a lot of lying in bed at night. I've done a lot of focusing on different kinds of things. But I just go almost like autofocus to this place of anxiety, of this internal kind of attempt to make sense of possible permutations of generally shitty things happening. And again, what was so striking was the physicality of it, how sort of palpable, how sort of sensual the whole experience was. It was very of my body, in my body, there's a clenching, right? Just to focus, you tweak the eyeball, right? You push it, you elongate it one way or another to find that focus, right? It's the same thing we do in a binoculars or a camera. But here I am trying to focus on something that's internal. And that in and of itself is neither good nor bad. That in and of itself is not a sign of anxiety or lack thereof. But it does forge or bring on a certain sort of a posture. Bring on a posture, right? I mean, I'm looking, trying to look inside, right? My eyes kind of, there's a kind of, you know, coming together. I feel like I'm cross-eyed in some sense, right? When I'm experiencing this, when my horizon and my point of focus, again, I don't mean to equate those things, but I hope we begin to see the relationship between them. Is internal. And you know, this wasn't a pleasant experience, this lying in bed at night and having this. And there was a sort of clenching of and a kind of energy expenditure, right? It was taking a good amount of energy. And this is incredibly interesting, actually, right? I'm expending energy to focus on the possible scenarios of a possible future event. That's very strange, right? You would think that would be, you think that would be free, you know? I think that would be, you know, no energy involved here. Yeah, heck, you want to just think about your own bullshit, you get that one for free. But no, it actually is intensive in its energy expenditure, right? There's a lot I was burning. And also I was like, well, what am I doing? Who knows what's going to happen there? It's not important. I was like, let me just focus on right here. Right here immediately became just my bed against my sheets, were still a little cool. That's always a nice moment, right? The coolness adds a layer of awareness, right? A kind of freshness to the event, right? It sort of brings itself into focus as opposed to when it's warm, it's harder to think about when it's more your own body temperature. becomes more continuous with yourself, harder to focus on. And then my eyes sort of relaxed. I didn't open them yet because my focus was not what I could visibly see, but what I could sensually feel, palpably feel, right? The air against my face, breath coming in and out of my nose, the feeling of the sheets, the weight of my body on my mattress, which I've decided is maybe a little too firm. You know, I used to really like it, but I've decided it's a little too firm, but I'm sort of reckoning it. The weight of the blankets on me. And there was a kind of relaxation. My eyes, rather than becoming cross-eyed, rather than turning inward and trying to find this point of focus on a potential, possible future state of a possible event, didn't have to seek anything, right? They weren't trying to focus on anything beyond my eyeballs, right? Because my eyes weren't even yet open. They were just focusing on the sensations of my body in this room. The very, very understated breeze, right, that comes through windows, barely there, but just a tad. And then I opened my eyes. And, you know, it's dark, and I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see that much anyway, but there are shapes. And some of these shapes are familiar to me, the light fixture, you know, the edge of the bed, my shape of my feet under the covers at the end, my dresser, various paintings or art I have up in the room. So all of a sudden there's been this shift in focus from this intense inward gazing or inward introspection is actually a great word in that instance, right? Because it's literally an introspection. It's of the spectacle of trying to find something internal that hasn't happened, to just this sort of placid presence, to just my body right there on the bed, to opening my eyes to the room around me and the light around me. And then I said, well, why don't I keep going? Where will my focus go? What happens to me at each state of my, as my horizon shifts? What happens when, you know, you peel back? You know, there's that famous Ray and Charles Eames movie, you know, short movie they made for IBM a million years ago that people in the design world love this thing. If I had never found myself in the design world, you know, I might never have seen it, but it's called Powers of Ten, you know, and it begins with a guy and a gal having a picnic. And at first it zooms out at a power of 10, right? Going an exponent of 10 further and further out. So you see them, then it goes up, you know, 10 feet, 100 feet. You do the math higher and higher until it's, you know, 10 times until it's all the way up in the ether and beyond, and then it zeroes all the way in. It goes all the way in. Its point of focus goes down to the most sort of refined molecular level, so I was thinking about. I mean, what this movie doesn't talk about is the sort of affective experience of having these different points of focus, right? What happens to mere experientially, what happens to my mood? What happens to how I experience life as I shift my horizon? As I shift what it is that even counts as the limit of my experience, right? So when I found myself looking sort of inward, but not at the infinite expanse inward, right? There'll become a point, and I'll talk about this in a minute, where an internal looking in and an external looking out all the way to, you know, beyond the Milky Way, to Milky Way and beyond, becomes a common look, becomes a gaze that is continuous, of an infinite becoming of the Milky Way within me. And I know that sounds fruitcake, but bear with me if you would. I find that, you know, as a kind of remedy, as a kind of respite, I seek the infinite horizon. I go to the ocean. You know, I'm fortunate enough to live in a small beach town here in California called San Francisco, you know. We think about lots of things. People talk about the hills here, but San Francisco's a beach town, and I can, in 15 minutes max, you know, I can be at freaking ocean. And I look out, and I see this infinite expanse, and this swell of the ocean, and the sky, and you see the curvature of the earth, and all the kind of little shenanigans of day-to-day life sort of just, whew, it's going to vanish, right? It's all perspectival, right? It's all relative, just this little thing, and that big thing, it just doesn't matter that much. And in fact, I have to be careful about going to the ocean. If I find myself in a good groove, I'm writing well, if I'm deep in the flow and rhythm of an idea and language, and I go to the ocean, whew, it just wipes me out, man. I lose all train. I lost everything I had. It is like an existential enema, right? It just wipes you. Never had an enema, but it sounded like a good figure. It just sort of cleanses you, right? Takes it all away. The other side of that, of course, is that it looks over the head of the social. It looks over the head of my child. It looks over the head of myself. It looks over the head of the people in my life I love, right? And they vanish too. That's how point of focus goes. It's how focus is, right? I'm seeing the infinite and all the little things between here and there sort of vanish. They become a blur. They become a continuous thing. The difference between a rock and a wave and a human being becomes minimal, right? As the point of focus and the horizon becomes the sort of infinite becoming, the sort of cosmic swell. But I think there's... I don't think any of these things are these either or. I think we always can have these sort of shifting. We always necessarily do have these shifting horizons. And I think that anxiety and that is that internal horizon that is not the infinite internal, but the staid, finite internal. That's narcissism, right? I mean, looking at yourself, that's narcissism, right? And that's what anxiety is, right? Anxiety is narcissism. It's thinking that all these little, you know, machinations within your own little thought process matter, as if they have some resonance outside of the madness that is you. When, you know, all you gotta do is sort of relax your eyes and move your point of focus to the room, to the bed, to the walls, to the things right around you. Not to mention expanding that purview to begin to fold in the infinite. There is something about this sort of intertwining of the existential reckoning and the physical reckoning of what even counts as the thing you're looking at and what is the size of the scope. Scope is a better word maybe than size. What is the scope of events that are even considered worth considering? Right? You think about it, you go to a party and you said something at a party and someone you didn't even know. You're introduced to a friend of a friend and you make some kind of introductory joke and it sort of falls flat. And go home that night and you replay it in your head and keep focusing on it. So, damn, you know, like, can't believe I said that to that guy, Joe. What was I thinking? And it's like, really, that's your point of focus, right? I mean, come on, man. There's like shooting stars and black holes and the sun and the moon and clouds. Not to mention, P.T. Anderson's Inherent Vice. I mean, you could just watch a great movie. I mean, you could shift your point of focus, and that becomes world-making, right? I mean, a world is somehow defined by the things within its horizon, right? It's an ongoing sort of New Yorker cartoon, right? You know, the world according to Manhattan, you know, according to New York, you know, and they cast the world, right? And they frame it in such a way that it shows that their horizon is quite small, quite local, right? That joke is, the only reason it works, the only reason there's any resonance there at all is because this is what we're doing all the time. You can't help but focus. That's what it is to be alive. That's what it is to be embodied, is to have points of focus, to have horizons and points of focus within that horizon that count as something to look at and count as a limit of that which comes under my purview. At what point is something no longer my purview? At what point is something not something that I even need to consider as something to internally inflect my mood? I think about this a lot in the political, and one thing I'm loath to even bring this up is I feel like this is going to bite me on the ass somehow in some terrible manner in which I will be destroyed. But one difference I have with people who pay attention to things like the news, for instance, the news is not something, I haven't read a newspaper, since I was 19 years old, right? 30 years, I haven't read a newspaper. I clicked on the news now and again when there were fires here a bunch of months ago all over the Bay Area. I was trying to figure out, whether I was going to burn down or whether I could breathe when I left outside. Of course, turning on the news gave me no insight. I turned it immediately off and realized why I never turned that kind of thing on. But there are a lot of people I kind of know who participate in a certain mechanics of things that go on outside of their community, outside of their house, but also don't happen up at the infinite scale, but happen at the, let's say, someone signing a law or a president or a real estate mogul saying something into a microphone. And this causes a lot of internal anxiety for them. Their horizon, their point of focus includes that figure. And I want to say that it's not that I'm indifferent to it. I understand the horrors and I understand the ugliness quite well. But it's not something I would ever let inflect my internal life. I have so many things to inflect my internal life, right? I have a relationship to my son. I have a relationship to some very fine gin. I have relationships to Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Deleuze, not to mention my woman I love intensely, and I have family. I have all these other things to inflect my internal life. I don't need some strange, weird, paranoid dude inflecting my internal life. Doesn't mean I don't think action should be taken. It doesn't mean there aren't other behaviors. But as a point of focus that inflects my internal well-being, my internal being in general, my internal way of going, I want to be selective about the things that I see, the things I take in, the points of reckoning. The great phenomenologist Maurice Merleau-Ponty, I don't know why I said it in an Italian accent. He says that sight is a kind of palpation. It's a kind of touching. That we imagine sometimes seeing as being sort of pristine, right? I didn't dirty myself. I just saw it. Imagine you pass some guy on the street, maybe some homeless guy who just shit himself, and you can look at it. But we imagine that that's quite different than touching it, even than smelling it, right? I don't want to touch that guy. I'll look, but I won't touch. And we imagine in that scenario that to see something is somehow less palpable, right? It doesn't actually touch the thing. But Merleau-Ponty suggests is that vision is a form of touch, that to see something is to palpate it. That when I look at you, I palpate you. And I know that sounds obscene, but I think in that view, we can really understand what John Berger talks about. I'm talking about the male gaze, this possessive gaze, this gaze that molests, and how a gaze can be sort of sexually aggressive and almost assaultive. That makes some sense because there's a seeing that is a kind of touching. But if we take it out of that context and say, well, when I see the sun, I see the stars, I see the Milky Way, I see the curvature of the galaxy, well, I'm touching that too. And what Merleau-Ponty suggests is that there is what he calls a chiasm, a chiasmus, an intertwining of seer and seen. That in order to be something that sees, I am something that can be seen. And as I see, I am seen. I touch my own hand. I see my own body. I am, it is this sort of recursivity. Not necessarily a mirroring, but a recursivity. And so the points at which we choose to focus, the points at which we choose to make our horizons of the limits of our points of view radically adjust how we go internally so that there's a space in which I can look at the horizon and the over the ocean here in San Francisco and see that curvature of the earth and see the clouds curving over that atmospheric tug. You feel the centrifugal, gravitational yanking of it all. And that can, if I look right, rather than being this subject who sits still in a spot and looks out, I become a point in which those things enter and recede in exact proportion, not quite mirrored, but enfolded, so that infinite horizon of ocean and sky and cosmos and Milky Way enters my body. I found this in Merleau-Ponty, many years later, more recently. I found it in the writings of Osho and his lectures on Tantra. And he has it as an exercise to lie on your back and to look at the sky and let the infinite enter you, right? Have this kind of enfolding with the infinite. The problem with anxiety is that I'm looking in at an event that doesn't exist, right? It has no real existence. That in and of itself is not a problem. It can be quite beautiful to survey an impossible or unseen circumstance. But anxiety becomes this kind of very tight enfolding. It's this very delimiting, radically delimiting field of view so that everything begins to sort of knot, begin to fold in on itself. And rather than a kind of feeling of expansion, rather than a feeling of just moving with things in a kind of continuous flow of becoming, you become this sort of knot of stinky shit, for lack of a better word. I said for lack of a better world, right? Which is a great telling slip of the tongue. For lack of a better word. So really, I just want to talk about, I just want to sort of say, very practically, when you're thinking about something, when you're thinking about it, think about the horizon in which that thing is situated. Think about what is the limit of the field in which that thing plays out and where are you choosing to focus. At any given time, I can focus, and a woman says something, she breaks your heart, or just the opposite. She says, I love you, and your heart is sent all a flutter. And that's beautiful, right? But is my focus just on her and me? Or is my focus on us within a life? Within a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, within the infinite of life becoming? Where do you situate yourself? And at what point of situating within this horizon, a horizon that is physically visual as much as it's existentially visual, right? What horizon, what point becomes liberating, becomes orgasmic, becomes beautiful, becomes relaxing, becomes illuminating, right? We see ourselves going through the world. The question is, with what horizon, with what points of focus that count, in what world do we exist?